When the snow falls, rise to the occasion with an Aaron's snow throw. Since 1933, Aaron's has been building durable, reliable machines that have been handed down from generation to generation. From powerful single-stage units to all-steel two-stage beasts loaded with features, Aaron's has the perfect snow thrower to clear your path down to the pavement. Whatever the forecast calls for this winter, it's nothing an Aaron's can't handle. After all, there's a reason they're called the king of snow. Find out why at your local Aaron's dealer. I'm sitting here at in my own home ski area's base lodge at the Spirit Mountain Nordic Center. It's the day before the final race of the season, the 40-kilometer long-distance race at Spirit Mountain, and I'm watching skiers ski by on this venue that I worked 12 years to help bring about with a bunch of other people, a lot of heavy lifting from the people in the area, and it's great to see the national championship here, and it has me thinking a lot about development of cross-country skiers in this country. And I have Brian Fish, and I don't want to butcher your title, so I'm going to let you introduce yourself, your title, but I have Brian Fish here, and we're taking this opportunity to put him on Threshold. So, Brian, welcome to Threshold.
Thank you. Thank you, Chad. Yeah, I'm the cross-country development director for U.S. Ski and Snowboard and U.S. Ski Team, and my role is really kind of cut in half. So I work on the domestic side, so obviously totally appropriate and relevant that I'm here. Right. Part of what I do is kind of help and oversee some of the events. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side is the development side of things. And really I'm a support mechanism now for the development coach, and that's Greta Anderson. So she's leadership role in the development coaching, and then I often support her because that was a project obviously I used to do in the past.
Yeah. So we've crossed paths for most of our lives. I think the first time I was ever aware of you is we were probably at the same ski camp, I think, in Northern Michigan University, and it was probably sometime in the late 80s. I think we're about 3 years apart. Are you 50, 49?
I'm 49, yeah.
Yeah, so we're 3 years apart. I'm 52. I think that I had that right from my memory from back then. And we've both seen a lot of things. We've both seen a lot of things in skiing over the years. And so I want to start kind of back there. Like,
okay,
when you were that young, you know, what was skiing to you as a kid? For a guy who's in your position, I think it's a cool place to start. Like, explain to me your world as like a 15-year-old and what skiing was to you.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I was super fortunate and lucky. I know you grew up in a family of skiers, and as I did, I was on skis just after I could walk. So, you know, like the sport kind of came to me and not the other way around. And a lot of times I kind of took that for granted. Now I look back and I'm so lucky that, right, that I had that. And I think probably you and I share that, where we're trying to give back to the sport and seeing where it was and evolving it. And boy, it's come a long way. I was also really fortunate growing up in a community in Northern Wisconsin where we had some good skiers at that time, all surrounding us, whether it was in my very hometown, very locally, or just immediately in the surrounding area. And I could bring up those, but those individuals are my best friends. I'm had dinner with Adam Swank here two nights ago. I'm staying with Josh Tesh and his wife, Kate, who grew up in Wausau. We all went to college together and skied together. So, it's building team, building community, and kind of looking back at the age of 15, I mean, I think I was always a competitive individual. But my passion for the sport is stronger now. I think as you're a competitor, you kind of wane up and down based on, you know, like how well you're doing at the particular time. Right. But, there was a time in my life, a couple of times that were really aha moments. Mm-hmm. One was when I was in college, I had an injury. I came back from that and I really invested a great deal of time, and then had a really strong season the following year. The other was when I came out of college. I went to University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. At that time, like I said, not only were some of those, like four of my fellow high school teammates were all also on the college team. Mm-hmm. Adam and I were the youngest of the two, and but yeah, it was just kind of weird that we all kind of went to the, but not weird. Yeah. And it was, you know, a really good time, and we were sending people routinely to NCAA championships, and we, you know, after Adam and I graduated, the coach at the time, Butch Reimer, resigned, and there was some times that they were kind of struggling with some coaching, and coincidentally, I was still living in Green Bay. I had two of my roommates were Jeremy Rosseth and Josh Tesh, who both now live here in Duluth. And, you know, I was still training a little bit, but they're like, you know, we could really use your help. And long story short, the athletic director at the time asked, you know, whether I'd be willing to help. And after some deliberation, and I was just going into a full-time job in engineering, and I said, well, I can, classic black and white engineer or math, I can be part of the solution or part of the problem. So I started to help out at that time. And that's how I kind of got into college. I kind of got into the coaching right. at the college realm. And that, you know, again, like skiing when I was such a young age, it kind of came to me. This opportunity came. And what one of the things that I noticed as I was continuing in my engineering career, I kept taking more and more time off to support the coaching. And I was like, yeah. And coincidentally, there was some conversations. It happened to be when the U.S. ski team actually cut their development team. So one of the gentlemen from my hometown, Chris Cook, was one of those athletes on the development team at that time. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of hit personally. And the U.S. ski team cut the development program, and the division sat down and had a roundtable conversation. And, you know, one of the things that dialogue that came up is, can we start an elite club program? Mm-hmm. And I was in that meeting, and, you know, I was like, yeah, it's a good idea. And I remember the following week kind of driving home and calling up Yuri Gusev and saying, hey, I'd like to kind of think about, you know, like helping on the assistant level. And
right.
And in classic Yuri fashion, he called me back 2 days later. He's like, how would you like the job? And I'm like, what job? He's like, the coach. And I mean, literally started from yeah. scratch, from nothing. And like yeah. my parents were really concerned because I had actually developed a good rapport and a good career in engineering. And they're like, you're talking about giving all this up. And I said, you know, the nice thing about this is I'm single, I'm young, I can always go back.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I said, yeah, let's try it. Let's try to start something from scratch. Yeah. And the way I looked at it is like, let's establish the foundation. Yeah, from then on, I've been coaching full time in some respect.
Yeah, I think that's what's interesting. So I think about that I go all the way back to when you were maybe 14, I was maybe 17 at that camp. But we really didn't cross paths again until we became coaches. I mean, I think that I took the job at St. Scholastica about the same time you took the job at CXC. And here we are, whatever, 20, almost 20 years later, sitting at a national championship in Duluth, which is really cool. But so when you took that job, you know, I'd come from skiing some biathlon World Cup. I wasn't a mainstay. I was there for about 3 years, and then I took the job. I went back to school, and then I took the job after I finished working in the Salt Lake Olympics. What about the job with CXC when you took it told you it was the right thing for you to do with your life? Because I remember taking the job. I said to myself, okay, if you take this job at St. Scholastica, you're 32 years old. you're in coaching the rest of your life or something that has to do with it. And it's been true for the most part. And it's been true for you as well. But did you have that kind of honest conversation with yourself when you made that choice?
No, it wasn't. What I wanted to do, and I was really fortunate in my engineering role too, that I had walked into a leadership role at a pretty young age. Some of the individuals that were on my staff were 30 years older than I was. And had worked in that organization. We were a spinoff company, and that's a separate story. But so I had gotten a level of leadership and a level of scenario where I felt like I had a pretty good confidence level of like establishing a culture, establishing. Mm-hmm. A level of excellence, and so I felt like there was a ripe opportunity. There weren't at the time. There weren't a lot of elite clubs.
Right.
There were quasi elite clubs, and then those elite athletes would generally ski for some sort of industry team, whether it was Rossignol, whether it was the Salomon factory team. But there wasn't an all-encompassing, like, year-round program. And, I mean, like there is today, and there's so many more opportunities. And, like, looking back, you know, to what there was then versus what there is now, it's just absolutely night and day. But how I looked at it is, like, okay, if I'm going to try this, let's just try to establish, you know, a strong work ethic, do the best of what we can with the resources and provide some opportunities to athletes that might not otherwise have those. I figured if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. I go back as an engineer.
So I want to talk a little bit now about the way U.S. skiing has developed, because really you've been involved with the U.S. ski team or CXC or in some capacity at the regional and national and even international level, developing athletes in this sport, in this country. And it's been for 20 some odd years now. So when you look at, we are at a domestic event with athletes who have finished on the World Cup podium, which in our day was hard to be imagined that there'd be not only one podium finisher here, but multiple. So we have some of the best cross-country skiers here that we've ever had as a country, and they're not even the best ones currently. So what have you seen over your time here that has helped develop that, both domestically with a race series like this? Let's start with a domestic race series,
sure.
And then how to get people to that highest international level, and that interplay between racing domestically and internationally, like on the OPA Cup. So let's start domestically. What changes have you seen that you think are really critical to that success model that we have
well,
now?
Well, I think you really need to strip it down, and you need to like identify what are the needs. Like at the end of the day, we need to provide the appropriate opportunities at the right level to develop the skills. And so I think those are all encompassing as it relates to whether it be domestic or international, and they're intertwined. But the way I look at it from a domestic level is like there are three absolutely critical pieces, and they all need to work together. Number one, you need to have programming. And programming means, I'll call it, U.S. Ski and Snowboard is a club model. We need to have local clubs. Mm-hmm. Then we need to have venues. We need to have good quality venues. And I mean, this is a perfect example as we sit here at Spirit Mountain. And it's so ironic that, you know, we're getting pummeled with snow for the last 2 days. But like, they are literally moving snow off the mountain because they have, you know, man-made snow. So part of providing opportunity is, you know, providing access to snow,
right.
Which, I mean, everybody in North America can recognize that this year that was a challenge. Without man-made snow, a lot of our athletes and a lot of our sport just would not have been able to come to fruition. And then the third component is what I'll call events. And events are beyond just race competitions, but events are our opportunities, whether it be camp, competition, or even like a Wednesday night weekly, like night ski,
right.
That that brings a fan base, that brings our community together. And a lot of times those events are like goal directed, right? Like those are the American Berkey. Like some people, they only ski a couple times a year, but their focus is on the Berkey. Right. Like, but it keeps and captures and captivates our fan base. Our best case scenario is the Minneapolis World Cup, and they hit it out of the park, you know, and like that will create and generate more enthusiasm for our sport, which it already has at the international FIS level. And we'll continue on the domestic level as well. So if we're doing those three pieces well, and they're working well together, and you know, like we're having good events in the summer and winter, we're having strong collaborative programming, and then we have the venues to provide access and opportunity within a geographic region, then we're providing that access and opportunity for our sport.
So my head fills with more questions. I'm trying to keep them straight in my head, but so I want to hit the next part, the international competition. Yep. Development point. So the next point up from this level, you can look at the OPA Cup, you can look at Junior World Championships, U23 World Championships, and we've improved a lot as a nation in those competitions. And you've seen it. You've seen it from like where we were really bad to where we've become really good. What is it about that process that we've gotten better at, so that we are better when we get to Europe? Try to hit that nail on the head for me.
Yeah, so I'm going to add another event to that to tie this to domestic, and that's the National U16 Camp. Mm-hmm. So we added the National U16 Camp in junior programmers. Mm-hmm. Did that in the summer of 2010. And it was an early exposure, an early opportunity. And as I was driving to this event, I was like, you know, is this too young? Is this an opportunity? You know, like, are we gathering athletes at too young of an age? And then I went and I saw the growth of skill, the unification of these kids, like, becoming kind of one team, and that is parallel to like why we go to our U18 Scandinavia trip, and then obviously Junior Worlds has a level or element of advanced performance, but like we need to ensure that we're providing our athletes with the skill set and the knowledge of what an international standard is, and you know, providing them that skill set. So like, yeah, if they're off it a little bit, okay, like they get that chance at the junior world level or at the U18 level, like, okay, ooh, wow, there's a lot of other people in the world that are doing this, not just me. And if they're back a little bit, or if they're right on target, if they're back a little bit, that's motivating. But if all of a sudden we're not providing those opportunities and that gap forms where all of a sudden we have our juniors hop in a 10K and they're 2-3 minutes back of like, you know, like that could be demotivating.
Right.
So we want to bring the right level and expose them so that, you know, maybe they're a minute back, maybe they're 45 seconds back. And I just saw this on OPA with a couple of our athletes where one athlete made a comment that she's like, I don't usually ski in a pack. You know, and it was a mass start skate race. The Germans were just sitting on her.
Yeah.
And I watched her like become a better racer in that race as there and it was windy and it was gusting, it was snowing, and kind of like what it is out here. And they were just drafting off her. Yeah. And then all of a sudden I'm like, you know, tuck in, you know, like Ed, I could see she wasn't comfortable, like, getting, but as I saw her, she ended up third in that race and had a really, really skillful finish. But it's like those skill sets and, you know, providing them that level of opportunity, because in my opinion, the field of competition and out on the race course, especially when it's a sprint or a mass start, that is the best learning environment for those kids. When they're learning out there, real time, seeing what other people doing, learning from one another, and we need to provide that appropriate step where it's not so big of a step where it's like, oh my gosh, I'm so far off. But it's raising their bar. And those levels are always going to overlap. There's never going to be one fine line for a particular age or athlete. Like, those overlap. You're going to have some that their baseline should be more at a regional level, maybe some more at a national level. And that's an effort, you know, what we try to do at looking at selection criteria to like provide that appropriate level of boost.
So we witnessed an absolute phenomenon in Minneapolis with the World Cup. Clearly people are watching, and enough people are watching, at least in a metropolitan area, to draw 20,000 people on a Saturday afternoon after the sport has never had a race here in 20-some years. Now, in the 20-some years, we as a nation have really become quite dependent on being in Europe. So from your perspective from a developmental perspective, how do you marry that balance between not just racing in Europe, but being in Europe and balancing that with being in the United States? It's a very difficult balance. And where do you think we are, and are we there yet, or do we still have to adjust that some more?
I think our system is quite good. It's stabilized, but it will constantly evolve. And you know, I think there are always three questions that I'm asking myself, that I think, you know, is part of my job as a development director is, what are we doing well? You know, what do we need to do better? Where in the communities, whether it be in the United States or internationally, where are they doing these things that are kind of what I'll say low-hanging fruit or opportunities for us to develop? Where can we tap into that emphasis to make it uniquely United American? So I think we cannot like employ a program or a position where it's going to be exactly like another nation. Like, it right. has to be uniquely American. We are not funded by the government. Mm-hmm. One of our huge strengths, thank you, because I know you're on the board of the National Nordic Foundation, but that is a huge game changer to allow us the opportunity to go to Europe, to bring our athletes and try to make it more inclusive. So it's not just... It's not a like so expensive of a sport. Mm-hmm. And I know, cause I work directly with some of our other directors in house, like, with, free ski and snowboard and alpine, and they, and even, our chief of sport, they're like, wait a minute, like, you guys get what from, you know, cause yeah. Those sports are trying to learn from us and create yeah. a National Nordic Foundation for themselves. Because yeah. a lot of times what they quote unquote feel is development or the money that they're getting might be going to just a B-team athlete.
Right.
And we really have to dive down. Mm-hmm. And I think we've done a pretty good job of that. And we've had to rely heavily on our community. But that, I think, is one of our strengths is collaboration, is kind of dividing and conquering. And when you look at our staffs going to Junior Worlds, you know, it's like two of our full-time staff and everybody else's club. And it's like, how can we use that as a strength to learn and share and continue to strengthen? So I think to answer your question, where are we? How are we doing? I think we're doing well. I think we continue to have to evaluate and continue to look at, you know, where are the opportunities to, like, every athlete is going to require to go to Europe a little bit less or a little bit more. But we don't want to create a structure based around unique people. We right. need to, like, do it on a structure of, like, what's best for our community. Mm-hmm. And we always want to use examples mm-hmm. that way, but, like, create a structure of sharing and collaboration, because our, like, the two biggest strengths, in my opinion, for U.S. cross-country skiing right now is our culture. And a lot of that is derived from that, you know, collaborative culture developed by our national team from the athletes themselves mm-hmm. and kind of has now dived down to, like, how our programs work together and how our teams work together. Mm-hmm. But also, like, looking at, you know, we can't just up and move everybody to Europe. right. and just like, let's just have all of our development in Europe.
Right.
That is going to significantly harm events like this, you know.
And your pool of athletes. Probably,
and the pool, yeah, because what you want to do again, that's where the overlap happens, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if a few are overseas and a few are here, that doesn't create a huge vacuum or a huge gap. And in providing various different opportunities at different ages to go over, check it out, come back and race. Obviously our World Cup athletes, they must live there.
Right.
They must provide that. And what with our domestic events like these super tours, like these national championships. Another thing I think with the collaboration we've done a much better job of by design is working with the local junior teams to try to have like those be junior qualifiers, mm-hmm. working with the collegiate system because that is a strength in our country. Mm-hmm. Our NCAA program, our collegiate system, have those races be in conjunction with our super tours. And then also the collaboration that we've developed with Canada, we continue mm-hmm. to have collaboration there. So like, how do we make North America stronger? Mm-hmm.
This episode of Threshold is brought to you by Aaron's Co. As a family-owned manufacturer of outdoor power equipment, Aaron's Co. is celebrating 90 years of shaping landscapes around the world. At Aaron's Co., they love all things snow. With more than 4 million snowblowers produced since 1960, Aaron's is known as the king of snow and is the number one brand of two-stage snowblowers in the world. Their machines are passed down from generation to generation. Visit Aaron's, that's Aarens.com, to find a dealer near you.
So let's talk about venue now. So we're looking at a venue. I mean, I've been involved with this venue that we're sitting at from concept to this. And what's really cool about it is that I have nothing to do with this organizing committee. This organizing committee is entirely volunteer run. And, Gary Larson was involved with the original design, the original concept, and he's still working. But I think he's the only one of the three who's actually officially working here this weekend. So, but just talking about venue development, man-made snowmaking is becoming a vital piece of the picture for this sport. And I can tell you, it costs, we're over $3 million now to build this over almost 10 years. How do we grow this nationwide, this sport, if this is the requirement?
Yeah, I think I'm going to go back to the term collaboration again here, mm-hmm. because I grew up in a community where we have so many cross-country ski trails, but mm-hmm. there's so many local turf, like, well, this is my trail and I only want to drive like 5 minutes away.
Right.
And at some point you have to go like, all right, we need to like pool our resources. We need to work together. And especially when it comes to like snowmaking, mm-hmm. we need to make this place, wherever that place might be, mm-hmm. Look at it strategically and look at the venue. Can you integrate it with other sports? Can it be a full year round? In the long term, can we put a roller ski track on it?
Right.
You know, like all of a sudden we're starting to like really think kind of more regionally focused, and more demographically focused, and go like these few places within the region are our mainstay mm-hmm. places. And another thing we have to recognize too with our sports, same with the clubs, we have to pay for it. Like, yeah. You know, and I think there's still this culture of like everything in certain scenarios, everything in cross country needs to be free. Right. Where like I live in Park City, Utah, and you go to the Alpine Hill and it's like $270 a day to ski.
Right.
You know, it's just a very different mindset. Yeah. And I don't want to create that an exclusivity, you know, requirement on our sport,
right.
but also recognize that it takes resources.
Right.
And if it's free, there's still a ton of resources going. Yeah. It's people's volunteer time. So, and it's the same thing on the club level too. Like if everything is being volunteered by a small handful of like volunteer coaches, that can easily run into burnout. So, so like what we're trying to do is like be strategic with those venues, identify and work together with other sports. Mm-hmm. Can we collaborate? Can we divide and conquer? Can we create a venue that is year-round that becomes a central hub for endurance-minded sport activity? And I think, you know, it's interesting at like Soldier Hollow, like a lot of their snowmaking is paid for because of a tubing hill. Like, right. can you be strategic and again, like linking in other things so that it's not all landing on one sport.
Right. And I should editorialize here. We're sitting at this venue and we were only able to really build 2.5K. And one of the things that we as a group continually ran into in the community was, well, you're going to spend $3 million on 2.5K. And now we're up to 3.0 kilometers now. But, you know, there was a lot of pushback from the community because they're used to skiing 10 kilometers on natural snow. But I think that everybody realized once it's built now that we've actually been able to pull a 4K loop out of the Alpine Hill here. So yeah. your point of that is really well taken, is that we've woven ourselves into Duluth, into the Alpine Hill. But if you look at the future of local clubs, where do you see this happening in small communities, or is this a big community project?
I think it's both, yeah. Honestly. But I think in the smaller communities, mm-hmm. I think that's where they really need, and it's probably going to be harder. Mm-hmm. It's going to take a longer, and it's going to take the years like this that are really hard,
right.
Where it's where if you're all doing these localized things, no one gets an opportunity to ski.
Right. Right.
And like, if you can think about it in a way of like, okay, let's actually work together. Let's like kind of pool our resources. And sometimes it's a little bit of swallowing our pride and just like choosing one.
Yeah.
And going, okay, this place, this is where, in low snow years, or this is where we're going to do most of our competitions,
right.
You know, this will be a central hub and we have all our local places, but this is where we're going to come together to provide a betterment of our whole sport, to make sure like from fall to spring, mm-hmm. we have access and opportunity to the sport.
So we are sitting in a season, we're looking back at a season now with one race left in the United States in which the United States had 22 podium finishes on the World Cup. And there's a, I know it's an intricate answer, but from a development, you know, you're in a national development role. Where do we go from here?
I think what we need to continue to do, and I think, again, this is an opportunity as well, is where are our athletes coming from? Mm-hmm. And the good thing is they're coming from all over the country. Like, you know, there is often enclaves throughout the country that, you know, there are strong pockets and that'll always be the same. Mm-hmm. But you're seeing like junior women coming out of the far west having like great success there in Alaska and the east and the upper midwest, you know, so there's a good amount of diversity. Where we go is we continue to focus on providing access to those athletes, and to be honest, to like continuing to ensure that we're looking at when we create events or projects, whether it be summer camps or competitions, we're looking at what are the things do we need to develop in our athletes. If we take the foot off the gas a little bit and, you know, we kind of like just coast on what we've always been doing, we're going to fall behind. Mm-hmm. So like, where are our opportunities? You know, like last year we focused a great deal of emphasis in our national camps. And what we often do is we look at what are they getting in their local programming. What can we offer that they might not be getting in their clubs at our national camps? And I think those sort of questions and being very very calculated in ensuring to provide those skills and tools. So things like we note is speed and power are areas of opportunity for us. Mm-hmm. We saw that we can do a much better job of sprint starting is another area where we as a country need to improve. So like looking at these, another thing we've been focusing on is performance psychology. And a lot of these things, when I say we, is not coming from the U.S. ski team staff. It's coming from our ancillary bigger pool of individuals. So performance fueling is another one. We've created resources and presentations at our national junior camps. So like when we go to these programs, even at like a U16 level, what we're trying to do is provide education not only for the athletes, but also the coaches and vice versa. They're providing us information of like, this is what we need to be working on more. And, you know, so there has to be a big skill of learning and listening and constantly looking at, okay, if we're tweaking our structure, if we're tweaking our camps or selection criterias, why? Like there's got to be a reason why. And I think that's where we go. We continue to look at where our strengths are, continue to indoctrinate those within our country to ensure like we're sharing those best practices and fundamentals within the country, and then going, okay, here's where we need to improve at the international level. How are we going to learn both internationally as well as domestically, and how are we going to provide those resources?
So you've been taking trips abroad with juniors and young seniors to the OPA Cup, which is the European equivalent of like a minor leagues of the World Cup and the Junior World Championships, obviously the best juniors in the world. And there's some pretty cool things. So just like from a non-skiing perspective, what does a young kid who is listening to this, who loves skiing, what are some of the peripheral benefits of making those teams and doing those things? Like what's cool about this, about making those teams?
Well, I think the same thing at the local level where you create friends and, you know, like you have your friends, you know, nearby, you develop a family and friendship with those individuals internationally too. And I think, you know, what is a really cool lifestyle component is by going international to see the rest of the world, to see how other people live. And, you know, I think that is a really cool thing to do. And you know, the other thing is, you know, cross-country sport, we get to see some really neat places around the world. The Central Alps, you know, Scandinavia, like these are places that you'll want to go back and visit. And why you'd want to go there to compete, because you probably want to be there anyways, you know, to check it out. So like, again, it's a great lifestyle. We can do it all our lives. But like, yeah, I mean, I think you really get an opportunity to see all these beautiful places around the world and enjoy your sport that you love.
So if somebody's listening to this who is a somebody in a community, any community anywhere, and they know some kids that are into ski racing or want to try ski racing or have been asked about ski racing, what's the easiest way for somebody from anywhere just to tap in and get involved quickly?
Well, yeah, I would, first of all, I would start with locally. I would find out, you know, who in the community has a local club and try to get involved. I would also, you know, do you just want to be a fan? Mm-hmm. And like, the question is, well, why would you want to support cross-country skiing? You know, and the way I look at it is like cross-country skiing develops really good people. I think it develops mindsets and skill sets in an individual that is going to create good, not only people in just like how they behave, but also like good workers, good, you know, very employable individuals. Mm-hmm. Like any cross-country skier, the skill sets that they develop to be goal-directed and focused and, you know, mentally and physically, you know, like directed, I think are good skill sets, and they're going to create success in whatever else they decide to do. So if, you know, like, why would you support skiing? I think that in itself, you're going to develop good people and productive people. So, you know, that's why I would say the other thing to get involved is maybe support the National Nordic Foundation. Mm-hmm. Would be a good way to, you know, get into the sport. Because at the end of the day, it's going to develop, you know, good society and good USA.
Well, Brian, thanks. I know you're busy. It's been a really fun week here in Duluth. It's been great to have you and all the entire community involved here. But thank you for your time and really appreciate you sitting with us on Threshold today.
Thanks, Chad.